Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and I'm your host. This is MJ Network, MJ after my sister Marcia Joyce, who I miss and who started me off on this road. So let's talk about this book. We're going to talk about The Dead Girl in 2A. The final result of a program so diabolic and so dangerous that lives are lost and two more are in jeopardy, and author Carter Wilson weaves a plot so intriguing, so intertwined and mysterious that no one sees the final result until you finally out the truth behind the girl. Dead Girl in 2A. You definitely want to read this. And Carter, welcome to MJ Network. I am so excited that you're finally doing my show.
Thanks, Brandon. It's quite a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate it.
No, I'm really excited. So when creating this plot, why did you decide to focus on a school that created exceptional children in an orthodox manner? I was one of those exceptional children, but I don't know if they created me in an orthodox manner. But this is scary. That's what they keep telling me, that I'm a little unorthodox. But, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, maybe you were part of the program. I wasn't sure at all about the school until kind of towards the end of the book. I don't outline, so I didn't really know the plot at all. I just knew the setup. I knew about the man and the woman meeting each other on the plane and, you know, having a sense of knowing each other. And then I spent the rest of the book trying to figure out, well, how exactly do they know each other? And probably about halfway through or three-quarters of the way through, it kind of hit me. I'm like, oh, they were orphans, and something happened to them as children. And I don't want to give too much away out of the book, but once that idea kind of came to me, then it was much easier to run with, and it got very weird very fast.
It did get very weird very fast, and I was wondering, like, I don't go on planes too often, buses, but sometimes, you know, you get into a car service or something, and then they want to share. Somebody shares your ride, and I go, like, I don't like that either. It gets you nervous, like you don't know who it is. So tell us about Jake and Clara and why they connected, even though they were complete strangers. That happens. Sometimes you just, out of nowhere, you just seem to, you know, connect with somebody or talk to them. And how did they connect so fast? It was almost as if they felt like they knew each other.
Right. Well, that was kind of the setup. So whenever I set out to write a novel, you know, like I said, I don't outline. So I usually just have an idea for an opening scene. That's it. You know, something that compels me that if I were to read that in a book or see it in a TV show, I'd want to know more. And the idea that came to me was exactly that these two people get on a plane. And I thought it would be interesting if they felt that they knew each other. But then I thought, well, what if they really felt that they knew each other, like even by smell? What would that be like? You know, how does, you know, because I don't like to talk to people on planes. I get on my plane, I put my headphones on, and I keep to myself. But if these two people independently each had this visceral sense of completely knowing each other, I wanted to explore, like, well, what would that conversation look like? Who would initiate the conversation? Mm. How weird would it be? And then what would happen? And I figured out, well, what would happen is they'd spend the flight trying to figure out how they knew each other. And so that's what happened, right? So they're trying to figure this out, and then I thought, well, what if the only thing that they had in common is that they were both orphaned as children, and neither of them remember their past before about the age of 10. And so I wrote this scene, and I thought, okay, that's pretty intriguing. And mostly when I write, you know, because I don't outline, I'm always asking myself the question, like, well, what if this, what if that? Mm-hmm. And so after I wrote this opening scene, I kind of looked back and I felt it was missing something. So then I decided, well, what if the woman at the end of the flight confesses to the man that she's going to her destination to kill herself? What does that do to this relationship that just started 3 hours before? So that became the ultimate setup. And then again, you know, I spent the rest of the book trying to figure out who are these people, how did they know each other, why does she want to kill herself? So it was just kind of an exploration from there.
Well, he was like stuck after that. He heard and he wanted to reconnect with her, and it bothered him, didn't it? He wasn't going to let her go for some reason. And that happens too. Sometimes
yeah.
You meet somebody and you just want to know what's next. So he was compelled to sort of find her after she left.
Right. Yeah, I tried to put myself in his shoes and kind of thought that, okay, if I feel that I know this person, like, you know, and not even casually, but somehow that I'm connected to this person and they're telling me they're going to kill themselves, what is the responsibility that I suddenly feel? Do I have a responsibility? Is it my right to try to stop them, even though, you know, we are just strangers technically? So I really wanted to make him conflicted and see what I would do in that situation. So he does try to find her, but he also struggles with the idea of, you know, how much responsibility does he actually bear.
Well, the best part was it was told in two separate voices, but usually when that happens in a book, I go, oh my God, why do they do this to me? You know, I'm gonna cry. And
yeah.
This is easy to follow. It's just that there are some people that write in five different voices, and I go like, can you rest it out here? And then they'll write something about one voice, and 10 chapters later, they go back to the next that voice. I go like, I can't stand that. So memories are at the heart of this. It's hard, yeah.
The only thing I was going to say on that was just, yeah, I exactly like you. I don't like reading books where there's a lot of different voices, and the most I'll ever usually do for a prolonged period is two, but I prefer to stick with one. But I decided I wanted to have her voice kind of be from her journal entries. So she's essentially writing a prolonged suicide note, and she's kind of recounting her memories starting from now until her furthest memory that she can recall, and when she gets to that memory, she's going to kill herself. So everything was done from, in her point of view, for the most part, from her journal entries. So it was just an interesting way for me to be able to write it. So yeah, I definitely enjoyed doing that.
Well, I think it would have been lost if you didn't, to be honest.
Yeah,
because
I think so
a lot
too.
Of times you don't hear the voice of the other person, and the other person, like Jake, if he said what she was thinking or whatever, it wouldn't have been as realistic. All right, or credible.
Right.
That's
correct.
Just me. So, memories at the heart of this novel. What makes Jake think he has an early... My mother had Alzheimer's, early onset and Alzheimer's, so I know what the triggers are. So, memories are at the heart of this, and what makes him think that he's losing it? And what about Clara? What does she reveal to him about death as her destiny? Flashbacks of Paragon. So, how did you create his memories? And what about his memories... flashback in the present, because that was like scary, because everybody does it. All of a sudden you say, oh my God, that happened 10 years ago, how come I remembered that? But he was remembering things as if they were happening right then and there.
Right. Yeah, I knew when I set out to write this book, I knew that opening scene, and I knew two other things. I knew I wanted to write about the Colorado Mountains, and I knew that I wanted to write about memory. So like you, I had a parent who passed away from early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 69, my father, 10 years ago this year, actually. So if you look at a lot of my books, there's like a thread of memory that kind of runs through all of them. And this was the first time I wanted to kind of really confront the idea of memory head on. And so I really wanted to write about somebody who wasn't necessarily sick, but for whatever reason, they couldn't remember their childhood. And they were slowly losing, you know, memories at a faster rate. So they had to question everything they knew about themselves and what they were at a certain point in time. Because there's something so fascinating about the idea that you can run away from a lot of things, but you can't run away from your mind. Your mind can run away from you, but you're ultimately trapped within your mind, and that's both beautiful and horrifying to me. So I wanted to explore that from the viewpoint of somebody who could rationally start to question everything around them, even though they've never had those issues before. So yeah, memory was very important. And so for Jake, it was very important to me that he started to have flashes of memories and started to have flashes of things that happened in his past that gave him clues about who Clara was and how that they were related. So, but yeah, it was a little bit of a struggle for me to write this book with, you know, thinking about my dad, thinking about the idea of all of that happening to you. And then, kind of, you know, because maybe like, I don't know if you're the same way because you had the parent, but, you know, I certainly always have fears. You know, if I forget something, you know, my first reaction is, oh my God, this is it. So there's always that underlying fear of like, God, I would hate to be in that position because I've seen what it does. But I think in this book I wanted to look at that in a little bit more of a sublime light. You know, I wanted it to be scary, but I also wanted it to be powerful. Like you have the potential to unlock your memory, and maybe you're unlocking something that's wonderful. So I didn't want it all to be filled with dread and horror. I wanted it to be more just mystical than anything else, I think.
No, I agree with you. Well, you know, I have a phenomenal memory. My husband complains that I remember the first day I met him 22 years ago. And I could tell you what he was wearing and what he ate. It's scary. I think that becoming a book reviewer and reading is... I've been reading since I'm three. And my mother made me read 10 books a week forever and take notes,
which
is what I do. So if anybody ever looks at my books, including yours, it's destroyed. I take notes and I circle, underline, and then I memorize the book. And I think that's what's helped keep my memory the way it is. That and my professor, when I took my reading masters, taught me a lot about understanding reading and remembering and going deeper. So that does help. You see, and writing does help too. You'd be surprised. It's these people that do nothing
all
day
muscle,
long.
Right?
Yeah. And then I wrote a book about my mom, A Daughter's Promise, because I wanted everybody to hear her words and understand what happened and understand how you deal with something like that. She was sick for 11 years, and I didn't put her in a nursing home. I took care of her myself with AIDS. So, and at the end of the book, the promise was, that's what it was, a promise, never to do that. And if I had to do it again, I'd do it again. And it was expensive. So we learned that part of them are part of a clinical memory trial. And both are given, this was really scary, a book, The Responsibility of Death. I was like, I really wanted that book because I wanted a human to read it. How did you create each one and make them different? And who is Eaton? How does he manipulate the events? That was great. And why does he meet him and encounters him? I didn't like this guy at all. And realize that there's something about him that's off. And then we meet some people that he's in the school, and we realize that something is really off. So how did you create that? That was really amazing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Another kind of hallmark of my books is there's usually a book within the book, right? So either somebody's a writer or there's the book somehow. And then when I was writing this and I got the idea that, you know, maybe these kids were in some kind of special school when they were young, I kind of liked the idea that maybe they were being subject to some kind of experimentation, but not necessarily malevolent experimentation, although from kind of the outside perspective, you could look at it and say, well, that's pretty messed up. And I decided that they, you know, there are certain things that they were subjected to that were indeed creepy, but were supposed to be for, you know, the overall betterment of the child. And one of those things was each kid had their own copy of a children's book, and it was all the copies were called The Responsibility of Death. Each book was different, and each book was kind of tailored for that individual child. And I decided that it was going to be almost like a psychotropic kind of book, where it was all the drawings in the book somehow had an impact on the child. And so I started describing these books, and it creeped me out too, because I'm like, this is a really weird idea. But I fell in love with the idea. I fell in love with the idea that it's a simple story in each book. Each book kind of has some kind of theme of death around it. And each book, the pages are filled with these illustrations that are only done in ink and are made up of thousands of tiny little hash marks that comprise images. And actually, when I kind of described Clara's copy of the book and the last page of her book, I decided I really want to see what this looks like. So I found an artist in New York City and mm-hmm. I gave her the description of what I had written. I said, hey, can you make this illustration for me? And she did, and it was amazing. So I asked my publisher, I'm like, hey, can I actually put this in the book?
Oh, yeah,
like, sure. So I love the idea that somebody's reading my book and then they come across this actual page and they maybe mm-hmm. question themselves for a second, thinking like, is this thing possibly real? They were all introduced to this by this kind of very mysterious character named Landis, who's trying to almost kind of complete the experiment with these kids who are now, you know, in their mid-30s. And he comes across as very, not quite evil, but certainly not good, more mysterious than anything else. But it was very important to me that you don't really know his true intentions until towards the end. I didn't want him to be this very black and white, I'm an evil manipulator figure. That's important to me with all my characters. I'm not very interested in good and evil. I'm very interested in all the shades in between. And so most of my protagonists aren't necessarily great people, and most of my villains aren't necessarily evil. Everyone kind of is trying to do what they think is best, whatever their intentions are. And it's up for the reader to kind of interpret whether they're good or bad.
I know. It's like, it was scary. But he, you know, at first I said, like, why would... gave them pills and flyers, and these books are written specifically for each one, and he seemed to sort of hypnotize all of them to agree into the program, and Jake didn't want to do it, and then he gets tricked into it, in a sense. So he was manipulated, so was everybody else from the beginning. See, my thing would be is I don't take pills. I don't like them. I mean, I'm lucky if I take anything at all. And that would scare me. To take pills. So that's sort of like those pills were a catalyst in a lot of the things that he was doing and that caused Jake to do.
Exactly.
And he wasn't sure about that, right?
Right. Yeah, and I think what I try to portray with a lot of my characters, you know, some in more extreme ways than others, is kind of like, you know, what would it take for you to do something, right? Because so just your reaction right there, I don't take pills. And that might be Jake's perspective, too, because the idea of, like, if somebody's offering you pills and promising you your memories back, you know, you immediately think, like, I would never do that. But what if you're desperate? What if you're losing your memories at a more rapid rate? What if, you know, what if that desperation overcomes your normal common sense? And that's kind of the balance that I try to strike, is because I always interject myself into the characters, like, what would it take for me to do that? I'd have to be really desperate. So then I go back and rewrite. I'm like, okay, this person needs to be a lot more desperate than I've made them in order for this to happen. And that also kind of just underscores, you know, that helps kind of bring forth on the pages like the paranoia and all those other things that add for a good creep factor for the books.
Yeah, it scared me, let me tell you. It's a good thing. And by the time I read it, you know, I have a very strange way of writing book reviews. My computer lately has been having a mind of its own, and it's not going to win. And I wrote a few reviews, and they disappeared right after I wrote them. I'm serious. And I went to save it, and it disappeared. So they are being lost because I had it. I don't know if everybody else has a notepad on their phone. So I write the reviews and the questions on my notepad, email them to myself so my computer can't lose them. And then I have to pray that I remembered oh, my God. And thank God I didn't lose yours. I lost a whole bunch last week. So what is the purpose of this program, and how come these six children were orphaned? Who is Elle, and why does she find that she needs to get Jake, and what does she tell him? That was scary, too.
Yeah, you know, and again, I don't want to give too much of the book away.
No, yeah, I know.
Kind of reveals a lot of it, but... You know, these orphans essentially find out that there's this program that was meant to experiment on kids in the way that, but the intentions were good. The intentions were trying to unlock their potential through some very unorthodox means. And after this kind of program went away, you know, all of a sudden, now it's three decades later. And there's a couple figures who are still trying to get the orphans back together to complete the experiments. So, you know, one of the ringleaders hires this woman named Elle to, you know, who's basically very, essentially like a private detective, to try to track down where these kids are today. And she doesn't have a lot of information about what's going on. She's just doing, you know, what she's paid to do. And so she's the one who finds Jake, and together they start to kind of unravel their, you know, his connection to Clara and what this program is all about. So she's almost, Elle is a very kind of conflicted character who's very good at what
yeah.
she does and gets paid a lot of money for what she does. And what she does isn't always kind of good things. And when she starts to realize what's happening and what happened to these kids, she starts to kind of turn away from her employer and towards Jake. So we kind of see a shift in Elle and kind of her fighting her conscience, you know, and deciding that she's going to kind of work for Jake rather than against him.
Well, this would make anybody not want to do a clinical trial. And I get stuff on Alzheimer's every day. And I'm like, I don't
yeah.
think so. And I would be wary of taking any kind of medication because you don't know how you're going to react. Everybody's different. And
right.
you don't know. There was one drug a long time ago that actually helped people, and then they forgot. They said they weren't going to pay for it anymore. So anybody that was improving from Alzheimer's is not going to. And you know what? A vaccine is very nice, but there's no cure for Alzheimer's. You'll have to take it forever. Even if they come up with a pill, you're going to have to take it forever. So people read and drink coffee. That's the key to my brain.
And sleep.
Read a lot. Keep your mind active. Ask questions. Don't sit around and watch TV all day and drink coffee. Caffeine is good, let me tell you. That's my thing.
Yeah, I would agree
so,
with that. Yeah.
So how did Jake come to realize that Eaton was not really interested in having his memoirs written? That was scary because he met him, and you created the scenes, and he says, I need you to write this whatever, and then you get, like, a strange feeling. When does he realize that there's something not right there?
Yeah, pretty quickly. So Jake is essentially, the reason he's on the flight to begin with is that he's going out
yeah.
to Denver because he's been hired. Jake's a writer, and he's been hired to ghostwrite the memoirs of this kind of mysterious figure, this wealthy individual. You know, and as soon as he meets him, the character's name is Eaton. As soon as he meets Eaton, Eaton is very cryptic and says a few things that start to trigger Jake. And Jake has already been kind of freaked out because he just had this plane flight with this woman that he's convinced that he knows. And now he's talking to this man, Eaton, who very quickly starts talking about memory and the idea of memory. And almost like triggering Jake, and Jake very suddenly feels like, I mean, there's something just even physically off by the guy, you know, and when you meet people and you're just like, there's something just not right about this person, or their energy is just somehow not right. And then what happens is essentially Eaton says something that triggers Jake so hard that Jake actually has a found memory, you know, an actual memory from his childhood that he's never had before, a very terrifying memory that even forces Jake to run to the bathroom to vomit because it's so viscerally powerful. So, you know, at that moment he knows, okay, there's something, this is not a coincidence that I'm in this man's apartment. You know, why is it that he really wanted me to come here? It's not to write his memoirs. So, yeah, it all gets very frantic from that point, as you know.
There were several issues that I wrote on this paper. This novel is about manipulation, betrayals, childhood fears, and one man's memory of his parents' death that's haunting him. Why these particular issues? Because we didn't talk about his parents yet. That goes up there.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear.
So, I mean, this was probably the hardest book I've ever written in terms of, the foils of being a pimp or somebody, you know, is you don't know where the story's going. You don't know how it ends. I just kind of write in a linear fashion with that opening scene, and I just start throwing things at my characters and seeing how they react to it. And I got about halfway through this book, and I didn't know how they all knew each other and what the history of all of them was. And so I had to actually stop for about a month writing this book. And I actually, what I did is I covered my office walls in parchment paper, and I took about 10 different colored markers, and I just, every day I just kind of wrote things on these walls, you know, not even outlining, but just keywords or just things that, you know, occurred to me. And each marker might represent a different character or a different potential plot line. And I just kept staring at these walls, trying to figure out, like, how do they know each other? And then slowly it all unfolded to me about the idea of, you know, something terrible happening to one of the character's parents, and that was his motivation for trying to remember the past, and about the school and the mountains and everything else that kind of unfolded in the second half of the book. But it became very intricate, right? It was a puzzle to solve, and it took me about a month with those markers and that parchment paper to solve the puzzle. And it started to make sense once I introduced some of those different elements there. But yeah, I never knew from the outset of the book that it was going to have anything to do with with any kind of school or any kind of creepy children's book, mm-hmm. or, you know, somebody's parents getting murdered or anything like that. But it just, you know, fortunately it all slowly unfolded over time. But, you know, it took me a long time to write this book, much longer than what it normally takes.
Well, if it just took 5 minutes and just, you know, wouldn't be the same. And, yeah, I know ever so often I'll say, gee, did that really happen when I was little? I mean, I frightened my brother last time. He seems to feel that he's not much younger than me. And he seems to feel that when we were born the same day, on top of which, I said, how could you not be smart? You're born the same day as me. And he says, I sometimes can't remember my friends. And he said, could you remember your teachers? I told him from kindergarten all the way when I graduated with my fourth master's, he says, do you remember every single professor and every teacher? I go, isn't that scary? Yeah, I do.
Wow.
It is scary.
Well, yeah, that's impressive. And some people, you know, just have, you know, have that ability much better than other people, even if they're, you know, essentially the same diet, the same amount of coffee or whatever else. And some people just have that ability, which is great.
My father always taught me to write everything down. So if I'm not sure if I'm going to remember something, and I remember numbers too, so if I'm going to, you know, I'm going to just write it down and in my notepad, and I'll say, well, this is what I have to do today. You know, I think most people don't remember phone numbers because you have, you know, speed dial or in your contact.
Right.
So if somebody says to me, what's your nephew's phone number? Well, here, read it off of there. Don't bother me to tell you. You should be able to read yourself. And, yeah.
Right.
So tell us more about Landis
totally.
and why he thought Jake killed his parents. And then he sort of becomes a pawn in his game of chance. And that's what's scary. That guy scared the daylights out of me.
Yeah, I mean, Landis is a very conflicted character. So Landis is you know, the one who's orchestrating finding these orphans, you know, 30 years later or whatever. And, you know, we start to realize that maybe he was involved in this program as a kid as well, and that maybe he was intricately, you know, involved. And again, I don't want to give away too much, but we start to learn that, I mean, it was important to me that his motivations weren't necessarily bad. Maybe the way that he was executing his motivations, you know, was the only way he knew how, which was, you know, pretty creepy and sometimes violent. But what he was trying to achieve was just his own memory. You know, he also was suffering from this memory loss as a child. He realizes something happened in his past that was horrible, and he's just trying to understand it. So that's, you know, I wanted him to be very, very much at ill ease. You know, he was just looking for peace. Before, you know, he can, you know, basically live out however many days he has left. He just wants to be able to find peace of mind. And the only way he can do that, he thinks, is to remember his past. And so he's got to find Jake and Clara because he thinks that they can help him to do this. But it's a very involved way that he has to go about doing this because they wouldn't just necessarily want to listen to him otherwise. So, yeah, that became a very involved process as well. But it was important to me that he wasn't necessarily an evil character, but that he was just trying to do things in the only way that he knew how.
I know, but I think Jake got, you know, he realized after a while. So who is Marcus? And what part does he play? There's some other scary people in this book. Seriously.
Yeah, Marcus is a fairly minor role, but I started to realize, you know, as kind of these plans got executed by Eaton and Landis, that, you know, there are some things that they just couldn't do themselves. And that's, you know, so that's important to me, is when you involve any kind of situation that involves, like, either kidnapping somebody or doing something that is against somebody's will, it's got to be realistic, right? There's a lot of times that you can't just, you know, construct these evil plot lines and they make sense. So you usually need help. So Marcus represented basically the thug, the heavy that Eaton hired to help him actually do the dirty work, because Eaton himself isn't a physical guy. Eaton himself isn't strong or knowledgeable about how to actually conduct some kind of a covert operation. So Marcus was that guy, and what was important to me with Marcus, as with all my characters, I didn't want him to be one-dimensional. I didn't want, you know, it's very easy to write a one-dimensional thug. But I wanted Marcus to have feelings. I wanted Marcus to have, you know, emotions, both good and bad, and to be human. So, you know, I strive to make that happen, because that just becomes a lot more interesting to me than just somebody who's just very, you know, very flat, and very kind of a flat character.
Well, when a character is too cold also, and too hateful, and too has no emotion at all, one way or the other, I begin to say, like, is this person real? But before I forget,
right.
Thursday, somebody we all know and love, one of my favorite authors, the Washington operator, Alan Topo. And on Monday, this is going to be controversial, but it's just interesting with what's going on in the news today. David Ardell, Confessions of an Innocent Man. I'm going to talk about what happens when this guy gets revenge on the people that put him in jail for the death penalty. And this guy runs the Texas Innocent Network, and he wants to talk about how he helps people that are on death row get off in jail. This is going to be good. Yeah. That's going to be an interesting one. I'm going to have to be careful. Okay, on Wednesday, we have one of my favorite people, Saddle Up for Murder with Cindy McDonald. On the 20th, Jeff Bond, Black Quest 40. And on the 22nd, Cy Weiss and I for a Lie. On the 27th, somebody you might know, I don't know if you met him, Jason Allen, East End. And on the 29th,
sure,
Jim Nesmith, The Best Lousy Decision. Jason Allen's book was sent to me by his publisher because, like, I never know what I'm getting. And then I said, oh, my God, this is too good to pass up an interview. So, fortunately, he said yes. And for those of you
great.
That want to know what to read, read The Dead Girl in 2A. I just finished yesterday in one day, Old Bones, Douglas Preston, and Lincoln Child. This book is absolutely fantastic about the Donna Expedition. It's coming out next Friday. This is School Cool being me. David Baldacci, One Good Deed, is another one. I mean, I get them all, and it's so exciting. And The Washington Operator by Alan Topol. And if you read Tess Gerrinson, it's coming out October 1st, The Shape of Night. It's scary, paranormal. So that's what Just Reviews has to say. That would be me. So tell us about Abby, his wife. He doesn't tell her the truth about the past. So how does that play out after a while?
Yeah, so, you know, we needed to see Jake at home, right? It was very important to me that Jake, we see Jake interact with his wife and his daughter. And Jake and his wife, their marriage is strained because there's been a car accident involving the daughter. And that's put a strain on their marriage. And so in addition to the strain, Jake is realizing he's losing more and more of his memories, and he doesn't quite know what's happening. And it starts to become a personal quest for Jake. And that was important to me, to have that idea of, okay, how much do you share with somebody when you are doubting yourself, right? If you're making questionable decisions that you think is in your best interest, but you know, for example, your spouse is going to tell you you shouldn't be doing that. That was a struggle that I wanted to see Jake go through. And again, it all kind of plays into that idea of desperation. Like, if you're really, truly desperate, medically, what would you do, even if in your gut you know it's maybe a really risky move? So yeah, and Jake doesn't tell his wife about a lot of these decisions he's making. And also, I wanted to make sure Jake wasn't, you know, black and white. It was important mm-hmm. that Jake wasn't just somebody who, hey, let's have this perfect marriage where I tell you everything and you can help me and everything will be good. I wanted Jake not to be that strong, because I think that's more believable, and I think it's a little bit more interesting. As I said earlier, most of my characters have various shades of gray to them, and all of them think that they're doing the right thing to the best of their abilities. But with Jake, you know, you're kind of like, wow, I'm kind of, maybe you don't like that he made that decision, and that's good. You know, I don't want him necessarily, I want him to be, you need to be able to empathize with him, but you don't necessarily have to love him. And that's what I try to strive out with most of my characters, is that kind of balance, which isn't always easy to do. A lot of my earlier work I had my first three books went unpublished, and all the editors would basically say your heroes are too weak, and they were right, and that was because that was important to me. I didn't want my heroes to be able to fight every situation that came at them. But it was a lot about learning that balance of how to make them, you know, strong without necessarily being, you know, overtly able to handle everything that gets thrown at them.
Well, I think I did. I'm looking it up right now. I'm pretty sure I did. I know I reviewed another one of your books. The first one? I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah, maybe Mr. Tennis Girl. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Remember.
I know I did. I reviewed something. So tell us how this. First of all, if I ever wanted to go into the water, this scared me too. Describe why do they have to do? Yeah, it's scary. Water therapy, and what was the rationale behind that? Water therapy and probably drowning people. Oh my God, I got claustrophobic. Just watch. Like I said, how do you breathe in that? Give me a mask, something.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, that was like. My intention with this school was to, you know, how do I create a very strange school with very limited number of students who go through these very unorthodox programs, but ultimately these programs were meant to be good. And I love kind of creating that duality of like, okay, this is supposed to be good, but the methodology is so creepy and seems so wrong. So that's actually one of the most fun parts of the novel for me to write, is kind of that duality. And so, you know, one of the methods was this creepy children's book. One of the methods is taking these medications. Mm-hmm. And then one of them was this, I honestly don't know how I thought of it, but it just occurred to me, like, well, what if there's a weird swimming pool that the mm-hmm. kids are basically submerged in, and they're supposed to, you know, hold their breath until they almost break through to this other side of consciousness. I don't know why I thought of that, but I'm like, that's really scary. So I just mm-hmm. decided that was going to be a thing, that somehow holding your breath into the point of suffocation underwater, you could reach kind of this other side that could maybe unlock your potential or help unlock your potential in conjunction with these other therapies that these kids are going through. And it just sets up for a beautiful kind of scene where you can write about how creepy it is to have these kids kind of being held underwater for 2 minutes, and what are the ramifications of that. And I knew that would get a reaction from the readers, because it's so disturbing. When I thought of that, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm definitely going to do that.
And my little niece is 5, and that's probably why she said, I don't want to learn to swim if I have to put my face under the water. So I'm not going to convince her to do it now. I mean, she's there. They're sending her to camp to swim.
Book,
and go,
that's
like,
for sure.
I said, you know, you're not going to want to read this at 5. So tell us when M realizes. It's scary. Like, Fran's not going in the water either. Tell us how M realizes that something's wrong with her. And all of the characters in the book feel damaged and want death. How come? That's scary, too. And that's part of the themes in this book.
Yeah. So M is Jake's daughter, and they've gotten into a car accident, and that was actually something that I didn't have originally in there, and then my editor kind of wanted some more scenes with Jake at home, and I was feeling like Jake needed some more motivation for something, so I realized that, well, maybe he got into a car accident with his little girl, and it was his fault, and that she's hurt, and, you know, she had some brain trauma as a result, and that kind of played in nicely with how Jake's feeling about himself. So everything became kind of very centered on, you know, what have I damaged my daughter, and is she going to be like me now? Is she going to have trouble remembering things? So it was just kind of another layer of guilt on top of that. And I think the second part of your question was about death.
Yeah. Well, they all wanted to. They all seemed like they wanted to die. The characters.
Well,
they just sort of like giving up on themselves.
Yeah. I wanted to approach. I mean, that was kind of Claire's whole motivation, was that, you know, she was going to kill herself. But it was. I started thinking about, you know, what happened to these people as kids, and what was implanted in their mind as children that could possibly cause them to have these thoughts later on. So I wanted to approach life as a very precious thing, so that there was almost like a conflict about, you know, how weird would it be if somebody wanted to die, but they weren't miserable, they just saw it as their destiny. So I just thought that was an interesting angle to explore. Seeing suicide, you know, I certainly wasn't trying to glorify suicide, but just kind of no fault of their own, they had these things in their minds as children, and how would that manifest itself years later? And, you know, so that was Claire's kind of struggle, was seeing suicide as kind of her destiny, and Jake is trying to kind of stop her from doing it. But, you know, I ultimately wanted this book to be a fulfilling book and a hopeful book, and you know, it was probably one of my more emotional books, honestly, and so towards the end, you know, I wanted it to be more life-affirming than bleak. So that was kind of the balance that I strove for.
I know, it's like you don't want to be totally scary, but even the ending was kind of scary, seriously. So we talk about his parents. So what makes Jake realize the hidden truth between Eden and Landis, and how does he learn the truth about his parents? We're not going to ask any more about Landis because, you know, my mother always said I had to be perfect. So I get this thing with excellence. That was me. It had to be perfect. And if I didn't get 100 on a test, I had to write it over. 99 wasn't acceptable. So as I'm reading this, I'm going like, I can identify with this excellent part, but not the rest of it.
Yeah, and again, I probably won't answer this question fully because, again, it would probably reveal a little bit too much. But it was important to me that, you know, Jake, the idea of losing your memory and then they start to come back a little bit as you go through these things throughout the book starts to allow him to have those connections. And again, that's kind of where the hopeful part of the book was, is a lot of it ultimately is about finding your own ability for excellence. Like I was thinking about that. Everybody has their own talent. And, you know, what would it be like if those talents could be identified at a very early age and then nurtured in maybe a very unconventional way, so that by the time you're an adult, you completely excelled at those talents? That was kind of the purpose of this program that Jake started to realize. But then the other kind of question that the book posits ultimately is like, well, what if your natural talents are evil? and all of a sudden you're being subjected to something that is trying to bring those talents forth. You know, they had never considered that possibility. So that became the other conflict of the book.
That is the other conflict in the book, you know. But sometimes there are people that would rather bring out the bad in people than the good in people. I mean, there are even educators that would rather make kids not want to learn, or make kids pit them against each other. I talked for a very long time, and I would never do that. No, my students, and I was talking to tough students in the Bronx, and I got along. I didn't have any fights or arguments, or I'm little, and they knew. Yet there are some people in this world that prefer to see people fight and argument, and it's whether it's from pills or experiment. Sometimes you're walking in the street and you hear people arguing, people like feed the fuel to fuel the fire, and that's
right.
Scary.
Right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, for sure.
If you listen to the news, you can tell. So, how did you create the final scenes in the book? How did you create that? I got like, oh my God, that is so scary.
Yeah, it just kind of unfolded before me. Earlier in our conversation, I said I wanted to write about the Colorado Mountains and I wanted to write about memory. And the mountains, I'm not really sure why I wanted to write about them, but it just kind of, I live in Colorado and I have never written about them before, and I realized that the mountains have that duality. They're both beautiful and frightening, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can have a sublime experience walking through the mountains. You can also get lost in the mountains in a matter of seconds. And so I wanted to write about them in almost a mystical way. So I realized that this is where the school used to be. And so once I knew that, and once I knew that the characters were ultimately going to kind of rediscover this place as adults, it just all kind of unfolded in front of me. I'm like, what does this school look like? What do the buildings look like that are now, falling apart and dilapidated? What does this pool look like, all this time later? I wrote that in almost like, just a few sittings because I could just see it all in front of me and knew what was going to happen. So that was a very exciting part to be able to write kind of that climax there.
All I know is that as I read this, I'm saying, what would happen if the school really existed today? What would happen
right.
if nobody knew that they would that there's a school that does this? I mean, I know there are schools out there that push students to the nth degree and expect them to be excellent, and if they're not, they make them drop out, or sometimes the kids just do the wrong thing and they commit suicide, which is really bad in some high schools. But what would happen if there was really such a school like that? That scared me because, this is like you never know.
And it was easier for me to write about this school as it took place back, before technology is where it is now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where it would,
yeah.
In today's world, it would seem more implausible that a school like that, even with only six students, could go relatively unnoticed. You never know what's out there.
Well, private schools, it wouldn't be a public school, but it would be a private school for the elite students
are
extremely bright. Yeah, and then the parents wouldn't know. I mean, that's scary. Or I'm going for a month and then I'm coming home and I'm a different person. I wonder if parents would even realize that something happened to a child. I mean, basically, supposed to give medicine without a nurse and approval, but you never know.
That was the key for these students all being orphans, right?
There was no other family.
It was easier to have these students not have people trying to visit them, having deep family connections. Because I think you're right. If it was just a normal situation where with parents, it would be almost impossible to pull off.
I know my niece goes to a private school, and I said to my niece, and she doesn't sleep there. She comes home, but I said before Katie Rose goes there, her aunt is going to look them up and call them, and find out what they're all about. I did, and then she was given an opportunity, and her mother knows I know things. See, they still think I have it up there, so she was given the right to go to the Freedom Conference in Valley Forge. And I said, before I do that, I'm going to look him up and call him and find out more about it. And she said it was the most phenomenal experience ever in her life. But we wanted to make sure that it was a real experience. I said, this is a leadership conference, but remember, it's in 3 days and it requires a lot of hours. And a lot of, she said, it was the best thing that she ever did. But we investigated to make sure that it was credible and that it was safe and that the people that were running it knew what they were doing. This is,
right.
I don't think enough people do that.
Huh.
you know, just say you're invited or whatever, or you're getting an award, because she's got a she's got a 3.296. She's trying to catch up to my 4.0. She'll get there. I told her, don't worry about it. So, if Clara, I like Clara. She was so set on doing something to herself. But what would, if she could speak to us right now in her own words, what would she say she learned about life and death? What would she tell readers about it?
Yeah, so Clara goes through quite an arc in the journey, because, as you said, she was completely intent on killing herself, seeing it being kind of her. She starts as a recluse. She starts kind of what most people consider to have a fairly normal life as a teacher, and then she suddenly becomes this recluse, afraid of the world, and then she finally becomes completely convinced that suicide is her ultimate fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all kind of stemming from what happened to her as a kid, which she can't remember. So she has some responsibility for her actions, but she also has, she's also a victim. So, and then by the time she gets to the end, she kind of has these epiphanies about life. So, I think if Clara were here right now, her message on life would be to explore, the cliche of living life to the fullest, but she becomes this recluse and ultimately realizes that she wants to explore the world. She wants to be a part of the energy of the world rather than, not of it anymore. So I think that would be what she would tell us right now.
I agree. And what about Jake? I mean, there are a lot of kids that don't receive, after working in a school, I've had kids come in and say, I'm going to commit suicide. A new kid walked in and I go, well, I'm going to have to call help. I had to call psychiatric. And they had to put him in Four Winds. And that was after he was in the school for 5 minutes. I wonder how many people realize that when somebody says something like that, you need to do something about it before it's too late. And I wonder if in schools today they even bother anymore. That's just me. So what about Jake? What would he say about life, too? It's a true story. This boy walked in and he said, I'm going to kill myself because I don't like school. I said, well, no, you're not on my watch. We're going to take care of this. And by the end of the year, we had him in a special program. But that's just because you have to push. But what would Jake say?
Yeah, I think Jake would Jake ultimately finds, not peace, but Jake ultimately finds his reconciliation with his wife and his connection with his daughter. So, Jake is very family-focused. And, that's his motivation for almost everything he does, even those things that make him look selfish because he's doing these things without telling his wife. He's ultimately doing because he thinks it's going to be best for his family altogether, and particularly his daughter. So I think Jake would basically say, do what you need to do for the family, that the family is the most important element of all of this.
I agree with that. So before we end, what are you writing next, and when am I getting it? Seriously.
So I just finished something new that I'm working on edits with my agent, and we are going to be sending it to the publisher very soon. And it's a much more of a straightforward story. I got pretty exhausted writing Dead Girl in 2A because it was so complex.
Mm-hmm.
So this is much more straightforward, although not simple, domestic thriller involving two sisters. For whatever reason, I wanted to write about sisters. That was important to me. I don't know why.
Books about
and it's
sisters.
It's set in a fictional town, small kind of wealthy town in New Hampshire. So hopefully it'll sell and you'll be able to get an advanced copy.
I hope so, because if they don't, I'm going to, I did something the other day, and I didn't even realize it. Between you and Matt Coyle and Dick Belsky, putting down, advertising books and telling people to read the other books, you have no idea what I'm expecting. This is like the only person, for some reason, and it's not his fault, I sent to Brad Thor's publicist, and she said, could you send me the links to your reviews? Obviously, they don't love me. Oh, well, what could you do? And I said I would love to read his book. But the book is called Memorabilia, and Carl is supposed to send me a copy of the book because I asked for it on Facebook, which is something that I do all the time. I don't know why, but I get it. So I want to thank you so very much. This has been fantastic and great. And my husband just took my phone for some reason. I have no idea what he's looking for. I have no idea anything. He does that a lot. He types, I don't know why. But this is great.
No,
this
I
book
appreciate
is fantastic.
You having me on, Fran. It's been wonderful.
I'm really glad I finally did, and that's just me, yeah. I did that. It was really funny. Do you know Lee Matthew Goldberg that wrote Desire Card? Well, Fran confused
him. I know
the
name, yeah.
I confused him with Lee Goldberg, and I said, I just read Killer Thriller. He says, that's the wrong Lee Goldberg. I go, oops, I missed up. So I got Lee Goldberg on a different show, and he came on my show, Lee Matthew Goldberg, and The Desire Card is a really good book. So for those of you that didn't read The Dead Girl in 2A, my pharmacist assistant is going to get this later. Otherwise, he won't fill any medicine or let me come into the pharmacy anymore. Yeah. I walk in the elevator, I go outside, and somebody said, what did you read? What do you recommend? And it makes me feel great because it makes me know that I know what I'm doing, and it makes it credible. And, of course, I'm going to tell them to read The Dead Girl in 2A. And, yeah, I'm going to tell everybody, go to Amazon. So where can we find all of your books before we end? So everybody can find them.
Yeah, in your local bookstores, indie bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and online. So all the usual places, in print and audio.
Well, for those of people that don't know, Silent Voices is my last book. It came out independently published by Southern Owl, and it talks from the point of view of the dead person behind the tombstone, gravestone, that either was placed there because somebody hurt them and they're telling their story, or they deserve to be there because I decided they needed to be so redemption. Yeah, I know. The first two stories are my grandmother's. They're real stories. My grandmother was in a Polish sterilization camp, so her story is told. And the other one is my other grandmother, who never smiled. And when I learned more about her, I understand why. So I want to thank you so much. It's going to rain, but it's beautiful. It's not that warm outside. Everybody have a great day. Quetta, thank you so much. Hope to see you at Thriller Fest next year. Everybody have a great day.
Thank you, Fran.
And bye.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.